Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 500, a conversation with Sander Hicks and Alan Duncan. This is being recorded on February 27th of the year 2005. It is my pleasure and privilege to bring to our airwaves Sander Hicks and Alan Duncan. Gentlemen, welcome to our broadcast.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
You are not necessarily familiar to members of the audience, so what I'm going to do is have each of you in turn introduce yourselves and present your credentials to the radio audience. Why don't we start with you, Sander?
Oh, well, thank you. I'm Sander Hicks. My website is sanderhicks.com. I'm the founder of Soft Skull Press, as well as the Drench Kiss Media Corporation, which publishes books under the auspices of the name Vox Pop, V-O-X-P-O-P. I'm the editor of American Assassination, a new book about the death of Senator Wellstone, and I'm also the author of the forthcoming book on 9/11 called The Big Wedding.
And Alan Duncan, and again, Alan, just due to our technical hookup here, I'm going to ask you to speak as loudly as possible so that your voice is up to the levels of Sanders and my own.
Okay.
Alan, please introduce yourself and your professional credentials to the audience.
Okay, I'm a former police officer. I'm a graduate of New Jersey State Police Academy, investigated major crimes in New Jersey. And since 9/11, I was a social worker for 20 years, and I did therapy with the 9/11 families after 9/11 at Jersey City. And after that, I became close with some of them, started doing research and investigations for them and Sybil Edmonds, and have a mailing list with a lot of very interesting people. So I've mainly been in the background doing research and investigations. That's basically what I do.
All righty. And by the way, for new members of the audience, Sybil Edmonds is an FBI translator and whistleblower who has called attention to a number of very disturbing aspects of FBI behavior in connection with translations and 911-related activities. And just this past weekend, the Department of Justice indicated that further investigation of her story would be harmful to national security. So that's just simply placing that reference. Now, gentlemen, you have been researching September 11th, as have I, and just in our relatively brief conversations, you've uncovered, for me at least, a number of very interesting things. Sander, I want to start initially, and by the way, if at any point when I'm talking to either of you, I not only want to sanction but encourage you to improvise. If there's anything that occurs to either of you to add at that point, that'll be great. Please, gotcha. Please don't hesitate to break in, because this is freeform radio here. Sander, you have published a book about the death of Paul Wellstone. I wonder if you'd briefly tell us the book and its publisher?
Sure. Yeah, I'm the publisher. The publishing company is Vox Pop. The authors are two professors. Both are award-winning, tenured professors. One is a Native American scholar named Four Arrows. The other one is named Dr. Jim Fetzer. I kind of commissioned this book. I got in touch with these guys, and based on some of Fetzer's writings in the Independent Press, and he actually got an op-ed in a major newspaper about the anomalies, the factual, logical anomalies that arise when you kind of open up Pandora's box and you go beyond the mainstream explanations, and you see that there are a lot of glaring factual knots in the story of the death of Senator Wellstone. So we did a book, and one of the strange anomalies is that the FBI was at the scene of the crime very, very quickly, and they were telling the news media that there's no evidence of any links to terrorism. But once you go beyond that and you do a little digging, like my guys did, you actually understand that the co-pilot in the crash had a relationship with Zacharias Massawi, who was in Minnesota. As we know, Zacharias Massawi was supposed to be the 20th hijacker on 9/11. He was the one that Colleen Rowley, the FBI whistleblower, was trying to get the FISA warrant, and she was stymied by Robert Mueller and the chain of command at FBI. And so Massawi did have a relationship to the co-pilot, Mr. Guess. Richard Guess was a co-pilot there in that day of the crash. And I'm not exactly certain I can tie the death of Wellstone directly into 9/11, but there is a relationship through Massawi. So once again, the FBI and the NTSB are wrong to say that there's nothing to see here. You know, that it was just pilot error, which was the official cause of the crash.
So again, the co-pilot of the late Senator Paul Wellstone's plane was a man named Richard Guess, first name?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah, it's Richard Guess. And Richard Guess at one point lent Massawi a bootleg copy of some flight simulator software, according to our research.
Interesting. And there's another, by the way, those sorts of connections, non-definitive, although possibly very significant, yet to be investigated to the hilt, I call those evidentiary tributaries. There's another one, I've forgotten the gentleman's name offhand, but one of the fellows who was decapitated in Iraq also had had his, I guess, his email purloined by Zaharias Moussaoui when he was down in Oklahoma. So there are a number of interesting investigative pathways to be pursued. It remains to be seen how much of the federal establishment winds up pursuing them. Now,
I'm sorry, it's Michael Guess. My fault.
Michael Guess.
Not Richard Guess. Michael Guess.
That, G-U-S-S as in surmise or guest as in?
Yes, exactly. G-U-S-S.
Okay, good. Okay, Richard Guess?
Not Richard Guess, Michael Guess.
Michael Guess. Okay, we'll make that note.
Thanks.
All righty. Well, I simply want to note that in passing, I was very suspicious of the death of, I'm still very suspicious of the death of Senator Wellstone, and a lot of people have emailed me, just simply due to the limitations of time, space, and money. I just have not spent a lot of time on that. But that is certainly something that piques my interest and something to be pursued, what I call food for thought and grounds for further research.
Well, great. You're not alone. American Assassination sold out the entire first printing in 3 weeks, and we're currently reprinting, going back to press, with a larger edition. Senator Barbara Boxer has just read the book and is crazy about it. And we've done some outreach to other progressive congresspeople on Capitol Hill. And so we're actually getting some of these establishment Democrats to sort of wake up and realize what the stakes are.
Wake up and smell the gunpowder in Dealey Plaza, huh?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
One of the topics that we've covered on For the Record, and a topic that both of you have investigated, and in fact we have accessed some of your research in one of the more recently recorded programs about Michael Chertoff, and that concerns something called Operation Diamondback. And we're going to pursue this at some length during the duration of this interview, but I wonder if you would briefly tell me about Randy Glass, Operation Diamondback, a fellow named Dia Moshin, and how this relates to Magdi El-Amir and, in turn, to Michael Chertoff. By the way, the new head of the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, right, who passed without anybody raising his links to a financier of 9/11. I don't want to dominate the conversation. Alan, do you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, and what's interesting, too, about the nomination process is myself and a couple other people actually contacted every senator on the confirmation committee and sent them information, one of them being a Defense Department whistleblower who personally contacted them, faxed them the information, and requested it be placed in the record, and she was just completely blown off. But anyway, I actually stumbled upon this information while doing some research for the 9/11 families. And I came across references to Operation Diamondback and was very interested in it because all the characters are from New Jersey and they were still on the streets. And since I'd been a cop in Jersey, I was pretty upset about this. As I started looking into the characters, I was particularly interested in Dr. Magdi El-Amir because apparently there was a foreign intelligence report that came out in 1998 that Congressman Ben Gilman received that stated that Magdi El-Amir had had contacts with Osama bin Laden for years. Bin Laden had funded his HMO and that money had been siphoned from the HMO to offshore accounts to fund terrorism. So I started looking more into Dr. Magdi El-Amir, and apparently he ran an HMO in New Jersey that was eventually taken over by the state of New Jersey. There's all kind of money missing from it.
Yeah, something like $15 million was missing.
Yeah. Make a long story short, as I was looking through the court documents and stuff, I saw that the lawyer who represented Dr. Magdi El-Amir during this period was Michael Chertoff. And I had no clue who Michael Chertoff was at the time, so I did a search on Michael Chertoff and found that he was the Assistant Attorney General under Ashcroft and on 9/11 was put in charge of the 9/11 investigation. So that really piqued my interest at that point.
Right. After 9/11, he was actually appointed to track terrorist financing for the Department of Justice for a program called Operation Green Quest.
Right.
And this was right after he had this brief period in private practice defending a financier or an alleged financier of 9/11. I mean, I think the final tally, when New Jersey did an accounting, they took over his HMO, they found that Dr. Magdi Alamir had $5.6 million unaccounted for, i.e., it probably went somewhere that was not on the books. And he and his brother are these major, are alleged to be major supporters of bin Laden.
So, again,
it was a major disconnect, and it's a major crime of omission that this never made it outside of the University Star newspaper.
I'd note parenthetically in For the Record programs 462 and in 499, we discuss not only the fact that Michael Chertoff was on top of Operation Green Quest, but that that investigation was badly attenuated. And in 462, people from the Department of Homeland Security, which is now headed by Chertoff, specifically indicated that he was frustrating their investigation into terrorist financing. Now, thanks to you gentlemen and also Daniel Hopsicker, we now know that Michael Chertoff was representing, had a professional relationship with someone who appears to have been one of the financial backers of Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
Operation Diamondback. Tell us about Randy Glass and D-Emotion.
Yeah, okay. Maybe I'll go first on this one, if you don't mind. But I got to say, in the chapter in my book, one of the first people I mentioned is Alan Duncan, my co-guest here, because it's Alan who tipped me off to Randy Glass, and it's a kind of he sort of threw me the ball, and I've run with it. Randy Glass is a former jewelry con man who turned state's evidence and became an informant for the FBI and the ATF because of his international ties to international criminals. To make a long story short, his international criminal ties involved an Egyptian arms dealer named D'Emotion and certain Pakistani terrorist arms dealers who told him that they were not only Pakistani nationals, but they were working for the ISI, which is the CIA of Pakistan. And in July of 1999, when he was undercover, i.e. when Randy Glass was undercover, working for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the FBI in a weapons sting operation, trying to find out, you know, who wanted major conventional weapons like Stinger missiles and who on the international criminal scene wanted nuclear components. They had a meeting at the Tribeca Grill in which R.G. Abbas, one of these Pakistani ISI agents, looked up at the Twin Towers, which were right outside the window, and said, "Those towers are coming down."
Now, this was when?
This was in July of 1999.
July 14th, I believe, according to the article that you did, the chapter of your forthcoming
there
book
you
that
go.
You sent. Oddly enough, Bastille Day. So,
yeah, right.
A crude and brutal significance to that.
Yeah.
Continue.
Okay,
we're at the Tribeca restaurant. It's July.
Tribeca Grill, exactly, owned by Robert De Niro.
Okay.
And now, Randy Glass, it's not like this is a story that is labored in obscurity, because Dateline NBC and a wealth of a lot of people have been looking into Randy Glass, and it's gonna be kind of an exclusive for me and Alan, because it's not featured prominently in Mike Rupert's book. It's in the Terror Timeline by Paul Thompson, but then again, everything else is too. We're gonna try to sort of focus in on it because it sort of shows that the U.S. federal government and the media are to blame here, because Dateline NBC did two stories on Randy Glass but never actually mentioned that fact that R.G. Abbas told Randy Glass that those towers are coming down. And to advance 2 years quickly, in the summer of 2001, Randy Glass is about to go back to prison. He, you know, the FBI and the ATF have very swiftly sanitized the criminal complaint that he and his the agency he was working for filed against the Pakistanis, they couldn't actually say what they wanted to say in court. The higher-ups at FBI were protecting these ISI agents. Now, for people that know a few basics about 9/11, we know that one of the great unreported stories in this country is that the head of ISI was a major funder of Muhammad Atta and wired many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars, and at least $100,000 went out on the 10th of September, right before 9/11, to Muhammad Atta from General Mahmoud Ahmed.
Mm-hmm.
So ISI's paw prints are all over 9/11, and we're further proving that by talking about Operation Diamondback.
Let me interject something now. Before we really get into some of the twisting and turning of Operation Diamondback and some of the really terrifying aspects of what people knew and who they told before September 11th, dovetailing back or doubling back ever so slightly, we've talked about Diamoyshin, an Egyptian weapons dealer, and we've talked about Operation Diamondback and Randy Glass. Tell us about Magdi El Amir's brother and how he ties in with Diamondback and with the scenario we're presenting here.
Sure. Alan, do you want to take that one?
Sure. Yeah. Magdi's brother, Mohammed, was also named in the same foreign intelligence report that was given to Congressman Gilman as a weapon dealer and having contact with Osama bin Laden for years. So both Dr. Magdi El Amir and Mohammed El Amir were both implicated in this document. In Operation Diamondback, Randy Glass was in contact with Mohammed El Amir, and Mohammed El Amir apparently claimed he had a warehouse full of weapons in Italy, and he wanted to get false papers for it so it could be shipped. So that was also covered by Dateline NBC. Like Sanders said, there were actually two different editions that came out that told details about this thing. So that's how Mohammed El Amir gets into the story.
Yeah, and one of the colorful figures is this guy Diamoyshin. He was sort of the go-between, this Egyptian arms dealer, who was sort of a celebrity in Egypt. He used to be a member of the national soccer team in Egypt. Randy Glass describes him as a Charles Manson-type figure who's got Manson-type followers. Randy Glass said that he's actually met some of these followers. So there's almost like this cult-like celebrity that Diamoyshin has in Egypt. And Moyshin at one point said to Randy Glass, I can get in any country I want to. I've got a special passport. And so obviously anybody that knows anything about U.S. intelligence can sort of see that Diamoyshin has got some kind of juice. And so even after, Moyshin was one of the people that was busted, so he did some time. But look at how little time he actually did. He was sentenced to 30 months. That's a slap on the wrist, because we're talking about Pakistani and Egyptian arms dealers that were trying to buy plutonium. They were trying to buy heavy water to do a cheap nuclear bomb. According to Randy Glass, 9/11 was supposed to be a nuclear attack. So for some reason, Diamoyshin, the guy that was trying to help the Pakistanis get a nuclear bomb to use on 9/11, according to Randy Glass, was only given 30 months in prison? It doesn't make any sense.
One of the things that this statement by Diamoyshin that basically he had a passport and he could get to any bleeping country he wanted,
it reminds me, we've
spoken at considerable length on these broadcasts with Daniel Hopsicker, the author of Welcome to Terrorland, Mohammed Atta and the 9/11 Cover-Up in Florida.
It's
a wonderful piece of research. And Rudy Deckers was described as being transnational, and it reminds me a little of Diamoyshin and his statement he can get into any bleeping country he wanted. But now again, he was shopping for nuclear materials as well as obtaining sophisticated weapons for terrorists, yet when busted he only did 30 months, which would suggest that he has an angel on his shoulder or something someplace.
Yeah. Look what these guys, one of the things that Alan and I like to talk about is the big picture in regards to the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. Yeah, 93, right. And how that, Michael Chertoff even then was at the U.S. Attorney's Office for that district for New Jersey and was also kind of reticent to bust people that were associated with Blind Sheik.
If I could jump in here for a minute, one of my prime areas of investigation has been the North Jersey area, because before the 93 bombing up through 9/11, a lot of the plans were made right in Jersey City at the Blind Sheik's Mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that the radio station this will be broadcast on is in Jersey City, because all these characters, Dr. Magdi El Amir, Diamoyshin, Mike Malik, are all from Jersey City.
Yeah, that's actually why we're here, Dave, because we heard your broadcast on WFMU.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it actually over the internet, I think about this time last week or so, and just I started emailing Alan and some other researchers.
Well, it you know, the programs are being archived. By the way, this is the station alluded to, as veteran listeners are no doubt aware, is WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, and they have the entire For the Record series on real audio, and now also some of it at least on MP3. It's available for download for free, www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, and a linked website which has the older shows for download only. And at the end of the broadcast, I'll also give a website, because there's a ton of printed information that I've got on the web as well. Talking about the blind sheet, talking about the 1993 bombing, Alan Duncan, you mentioned, one of the things that you've uncovered is that Dr. Magdi El-Amir also had links to the blind sheik's mosque and apparently given him money. Tell us about that, if you would.
Oh, there's a huge Egyptian, well, it's a pretty large segment of the population. Jersey City is Egyptian. There's Coptic Christians and there's Muslims, and there's the Al-Salam Mosque there that the blind sheik used to preach at. And apparently Dr. El-Amir has been a regular financier of that mosque.
And so there's yet another tributary running between Dr. El-Amir, who was represented by Michael Chertoff, and the mosque, which was an epicenter for some of the terrorist activity that preceded 9/11 and included the World Trade Center attack.
Yeah, let me jump in, too, and say, you know, Dateline NBC did a good job by sticking a camera in Dr. El-Amir's face. They, like, staked him out in his parking lot of his HMO. And they said, do you know Dia Moishin, the Egyptian arms dealer? And he kind of hemmed and hawed, and then he said, well, yes, well, he's a friend of the family.
So he actually paid $5,000 to Dia Moishin from his business.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Interesting.
They all knew each other. There was no doubt about it.
So let's remind the listeners, we're talking about the Dia Moishin, the Egyptian arms dealer, who's the Charles Manson of Egypt, is a friend of the family with Dr. Magdi El-Amir, who was the client of Michael Chertoff during his brief stint in private practice, which is not so private. And now we're talking about Chertoff just glided into his post at the Director of Homeland Security. It doesn't make any sense. This country's in real trouble.
And note that DHS.
If I can jump in quick, one of the things that really bothered me was it was apparent that Chertoff couldn't take care of his own damn backyard.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, since before 93, when he's the state attorney, all the way up through being assistant attorney general under Ashcroft and knowing these people, he didn't stop anything. So how the hell is he going to...
But Alan, is it he couldn't or he did or he wouldn't? You know, is it like...
That's it. We don't know.
Yeah. You know, but we can sort of speculate based on the best evidence and try to say, like, gee, these guys... they have, like, you know, this $400 billion a year war machine behind them. They've got the $40 billion a year U.S. intelligence machine behind them. You know, you'd think they could be a little bit more competent. So therefore, logically, it seems that things don't happen for a reason. People don't get prosecuted for a reason.
Well, one thing that really bothered me too was, and what actually put me on Chertoff's trail, was I always wondered, why did Magdi El-Amir, Mike Malik get no time, mm-hmm. Dia Moishin only 30 years?
Right.
What happened? Why were they not prosecuted? And it turned out that Operation Diamondback was still in operation when Chertoff was appointed Assistant Attorney General under Ashcroft. The case culminated in arrest in the summer of 2001, Well, and it would have fallen under his purview because it was handled as a criminal case, not a counterterrorism case,
mm-hmm.
much to the chagrin of many of the investigators. They always wondered why this wasn't kicked up to a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, there's a lot of questions about that, too. You know, this case would have fallen under his purview. One of his own clients is a suspect. Is that why maybe some of these people didn't get arrested? Would it have come out that he would have been Dr. Magdi El-Amir's lawyer and it would have come back to him? Mm-hmm. These are things we need to find out.
One of the things that I want to note very quickly in passing is that it would appear that the relationship between Chertoff and Dr. Magdi El-Amir is certainly similar to, and who knows, perhaps part of the same phenomenon as a larger connection between, direct connection between the GOP and individuals and institutions alleged to have financed not only Al-Qaeda but Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. That is Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute, members of which or affiliates of which were busted on March 20th, 2002. It's a direct link. link between some of the innermost sancta of the GOP and individuals alleged to have been financing al-Qaeda and the roots going back to the Afghan Mujahideen effort. Let's jump now back to Operation Diamondback, and we've talked about Randy Glass. We've talked about Rulam G. Abbas, an ISI Pakistani intelligence agent who on July 14, 2001 at the Tribeca Grill turned around, pointed to the World Trade Center towers and said those towers are coming down.
Quick correction, that was actually in 99. That was July 14th, 99.
Oh, it was not July of 2001?
No, it was it would seem that it would be that close, but no. In July of 2001, in August of 2001, Randy Glass was trying to get the federal government to react to what he knew based on R.G. Abbas saying that in 99 and his whole investigation. The investigation culminated in about June of 2001.
Okay. So we're basically that the prophetic remark by Rulam G. Abbas, Pakistani.
R.G. Abbas. People tend to know him as R.G. Abbas in most of the books.
All right. R.G. Abbas, a Pakistani intelligence agent in June of 1999, turns around from the Tribeca Grill, points at the Twin Towers and says those towers are coming down.
Right, July 14th, 1999, right.
Okay.
All recorded, by the way, by the FBI Terrorism Task Force.
Oh, yeah, they had all kinds of people on undercover in that restaurant.
Okay, and now Randy Glass, when Operation Diamondback took place in 2001, Randy Glass took this information and went to some people in positions of power. One of those was Senator Robert Graham of Florida. Tell us about that. We have about 2 minutes left on this side, maybe a little less, so we will continue with this narrative on side two. Tell us about Robert Graham, Randy Glass, and what Randy had to communicate to Robert Graham.
Sure. Yeah, we did a TV debut of that, and the video is still up online. You can get a link to it at sanderhicks.com. And because Randy sent us the tapes of Senator Bob Graham being confronted at a press conference, and they asked him. They said, like, listen, in the summer of 2001, the FBI informant Randy Glass contacted your office. He was faxing his senator and his congress people, and he was frantically trying to warn you about an impending attack on the World Trade Center. And Senator Bob Graham on the tape nods, and he says, yes, I was trying to process a number of different warnings I was getting at that time. He gives a real kind of like D.C. kind of insider, you know, the basic D.C. response of like, well, kind of inhuman and robotic.
Excuse me for interrupting, gentlemen. Let's pick this up on side two. Very quickly, give us contact information about websites, et cetera, where people can find out more about both of you.
Sure. Well, you know, Alan and I are both on the DrenchKiss.com website, which is the media company that we're affiliated with here in New York. That's Drench, DrenchKiss.com. SanderHicks.com is my personal site, and VoxPopNet.net is the VoxPop site. Alan?
Yeah, I don't have a website. I just kind of stay quiet behind the scenes and do my investigations and research. But there is contact information for me on Sanders' website.
And everyone should know that Alan runs one of the best email lists, not of his own opinions, but of basically news clippings that are relevant to the continuing people's investigation into 9/11. And I highly recommend you contact either me or Alan. His email is out there, and get on his email list, and you won't regret it. Some powerful people are on Alan's email list.
All righty. What we will do is I'll get this information on the description for this broadcast. It'll be available at www.spitfirelist.com. They're long written annotated descriptions of the For the Record shows. The description for number 500, this broadcast, we'll have all of that relevant information. So, Alan, you like to speak softly and carry a big internet stick, a big cyber stick.
Yeah.
Okay. We will continue with this fascinating discussion on side two of this broadcast. This concludes side one of For the Record number 500, conversation with Sander Hicks and Alan Duncan, being recorded on February 27th of the year 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.